countdown shortly here. In H minus 10 seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. It is the 28th of May in the glorious future year of 2022. Let's see. This is not going to be a show like last week, pre-recorded with high production values. Sorry, SMJ, you're not going to get one of those every week. There will be one next week, however. I've already done the recording, now I just have to do the editing, because I am going to be at ACON. ACON is a Dallas area anime convention which has been going on since 1990. Of course, it hasn't happened the last 2 years, for unavoidable reasons. But it is back this year, and so I, too, will be back with the event that I always do there, that I have been doing for, since, 2008 or so, practically 15 years, which is my classic anime festival, where I bring my Laserdisc player and a selection of Laserdiscs of Japanese animation programs, some of them the kinds of things that really drove the growth of the fandom in its early days, and some of them kind of obscure. Because the truth is, anime, Japanese media of every kind, is everywhere nowadays. This wasn't true in the 80s and 90s, right? And it's really easy to be a fan of things today because they're very accessible. So the question that I want people to think about is, what, back in the days when this stuff was not accessible, what produced so much enthusiasm that people were willing to go to the effort of getting hold of it? Anyway, so let's see, a couple of notes from the news, I suppose. Firstly, Boeing is to be congratulated for finally having completed an unmanned test flight of their CST-100 Starliner capsule, which went to the International Space Station, docked, and returned safely to Earth. The previous test flight that they did not manage to dock with the ISS. In fact, apparently it got a trifle hair-raising there for a little while. I will note that although the capsule did not have any people in it, it did have a plushie of Jebediah Kerman, the little sort of green astronaut guy from Kerbal Space Program. Apparently you can tell him because he's the one who's not terrified all the time. So, yeah, apparently the folks at Boeing have been playing Kerbal Space Program. There's probably some folks there who are young enough that that's how they get started doing space stuff, which is amusing to me and also somewhat gratifying. Let's see, what else do I have to say about... I think that's about all I have to say about that. Other than that, unlike the SpaceX Crew Dragon, the CST-100 actually touches down on dry land. They're doing that in New Mexico, out at White Sands, near the runway where the space shuttle Columbia made exactly one landing. Yeah, because it turns out that the sand at White Sands is not silica the way you think. It's actually gypsum dust. And so they picked up the space shuttle orbiter, flew it back to Florida, where the humidity is very high, and all the gypsum dust that had got into the interstices of the thermal tiles and up into the reaction control system motors and all that kind of thing turned into plaster of Paris. And they were months chipping it out. In fact, at one point, they thought they were going to have to scrap the orbiter. So that's fun. Yeah, they are using a an airbag system as opposed to the, frankly, rather violent by all accounts, retro rocket system that the Soyuz capsules use when they land on dry land somewhere in Russia or Central Asia. See, is there anything else I can say about that? No, I think that's about it. And then, you may have heard last Saturday, so a week ago, when I was doing my show, actually, the Russians officially cut off all deliveries of fossil methane, goes under the trade name of natural gas to distinguish it from manufactured gas made from coal, cut off all deliveries of fossil methane to Finland. The Finns say they're not really bothered one way or the other. Because, of course, back on March 12th, they started up the long, 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 long-delayed Olkiluoto 3 nuclear power station. 1,600 megawatts, nearly twice the output of the either Olkiluoto 1 or 2, which are about 900. Then there's Loviisa 1 and 2, which started life as VVER 440 units, 440 megawatt Soviet-built reactors, and have been uprated to almost 600. Anyway, the point is that Olkiluoto 3 all by itself is far and away the largest generating unit on the entire Finnish power network. And bringing it into operation shut down, literally overnight, the gas-fired power plants in Finland. So right now, they have no particular demand for gas. There's small amounts of it in use as motor fuel, and there's small amounts required for cooking and water heating and residential heating. But again, the winter heating season is over. Now, 6 months from now, what are things going to look like? Not clear, but the Finns are certainly hoping that with their connections to Norway and so on, they can refill their reservoirs before the heating season starts up. Interestingly enough, judging by the experience at Greifswald in East Germany, and then more recently, the pipeline that was built between Temelin in the Czech Republic and the city of Budějovice, where the beer comes from, Budweis. It appears very likely that if emergency planning permissions were given, that a pressurized hot water pipeline could be built from the Loviisa nuclear power station to Helsinki to feed heat into the district heating systems there, thus greatly reducing the demand for fuel, whether that be gas or indeed coal, which is still burned in some district heating systems. Back in 2010, the Finnish authorities approved two nuclear power plant proposals and rejected one, and the two approved were for Olkiluoto 4, for which there are still no completely definite plans, and Hanhiviki. Well, Hanhiviki was supposed to use a Russian-built VVER 1200, and that contract has been canceled for obvious reasons. The whole idea behind these approvals was that as soon as Olkiluoto 3 came on the line, then a new nuclear plant could be started. Finland being the small country that it is, it doesn't make sense to have more than one being built at the same time, essentially, because each one is such a big chunk of the country's whole electricity need. But yeah, Olkiluoto 4, there are still no definite plans for. Hanhiviki has, the contract that existed has been canceled, and everything's going to have to be replanned from the beginning, it looks like. And then the one that was rejected was for a third unit at Loviisa specifically for combined heat and power. And I think it now looks like rejecting that was a pretty stupid idea. But again, significant quantities of heat can be taken off the Loviisa plant, the two reactors there, without major modifications. And so hopefully the Finnish authorities will see the light, and hopefully we'll get a hot water pipeline to serve Helsinki, you know, not necessarily by the beginning of this year's heating season, but hopefully, you know, before midwinter. Just checking comments in comm. Let's see. So yes, so this is not a slick pre-produced show. It's also not a call-in show with guests, although I'm planning some of those. I was talking to Dr. Ronald Knief of Sandia National Laboratory, who has an interesting history in the nuclear power field and currently teaches people how not to build nuclear reactors. Specifically, when working with certain kinds of nuclear materials, it is possible to put together a critical assembly without meaning to, and the consequences of that are often fairly dire. And so he teaches people how to avoid that scenario. How to not build a nuclear reactor when you don't want one. It's normally quite difficult, but people have managed it in the past, and particularly there have been problems with assemblies of material which are supposed to be critical under certain conditions, and people messing around with them and violating those conditions without expecting to. Nasty thing that can happen. But yeah, I'm hoping that he's making progress on getting those nuclear power plant diagrams that I sent him scanned. But I also hope that he'll be willing to come on the show one day and be a guest on the telephone conference. Comment in comm. It's kind of like knowing what kind of mushrooms to not eat. Which is pretty fair, I think. So, yeah. Anyway. But I have notes for today's show, believe it or not, telling me what I'm supposed to be talking about. And those notes remind me to once again restate the general theme of this show, which is essentially science and technology and their intersection with the future of humanity. And, you know, I tend to talk a lot about space travel and nuclear energy because I think that on a long-term scale, those two things are absolutely central to the future of humanity, and indeed of life as we know it. But they're certainly not the only topics of interest. And I don't want to come across as a Johnny One Note either. Again, poor value for money, just as if, you know, you were to say of me, oh, he just says what everyone is thinking. Again, I hope not. But so here's a thought for you. And I want to just sort of float it along, float it into your minds, and see what happens when it gets there. The original social technology, if you will, the thing that really differentiates us as humans from pretty much any other living things. I say pretty much because there's some uncertainty about, you know, there's things we don't necessarily know or understand fully. But speech. Think about it. Speech. Right? It's speech which is it's not just a means of communicating with each other. It's also a means of creating things like abstract ideas that you can use speech to frame and organize concepts. So we can talk about talking, and we can think about talking, and we can talk about thinking, and we can think about thinking. We can do stuff like philosophy. We can do stuff like future planning. We can construct mental, not just images, right? We can construct mental images of things that don't exist in our environment, and then we can convey them to other people. And we can contemplate the future, things which haven't happened yet. And we can look for patterns in the past, things which have already happened, and we can relate those to the present, what is happening now, by means of speech. It's an incredibly rich and powerful tool and technology, if you will, even if I am venturing into using the word technology in a somewhat L. Ron Hubbard sense here. Speech is an incredibly powerful technology, the spoken word. Now, it has two really important characteristics, though, which limit it. And I'll remark, by the way, you know, people construct little toy languages like Toki Pona or whatever that have very limited vocabulary, very limited ability to elaborate concepts and articulate them. And then they, of course, when people start using these toy languages at all, they have to find ways to express those things that the toy language is specifically designed not to do. So it's a fascinating process to watch that happen, and it really blows the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis out of the water. You know, the Sapir-Whorf would have you believe that if somebody's language doesn't have a future tense, then they don't think about events that haven't happened yet in a way that's distinct from events that are happening now or have happened in the past. And sure, language, because it's the way we frame concepts, right, affects the way that we think. But, you know, half of the dialogues of Plato are on this topic. You know, picking apart the way that we use concepts that are embedded in our languages somewhat casually and without thinking about them, and are led into errors of thinking as a result. Anyway, but speech has two great limitations. The first is that it is instantaneous. You speak a word, and it's gone. It's the most evanescent possible thing. The second is that its range is limited. Even if you have a very loud and projective voice, and are in a very quiet space with good properties, it's difficult for anyone to hear you more than about 100 meters away. Now, sometime 7,000-10,000 years ago, a long time ago, people came up with the idea of making signs that represented words, speech, spoken language. And, you know, so the Egyptian hieroglyphic system and the many different systems that derived from that, you know, the Phoenician symbols, which were imitative of, patterned after the Egyptian system, but not directly derived from it, and that then led to the purely phonetic systems. Well, I say purely phonetic. The truth is the Latin alphabet, at least as English speakers use it, is far from being purely phonetic. It's about as impurely phonetic as you can get. But still, the extent to which we use symbol clusters to represent concepts rather than sounds is very limited. And of course, you look at even Chinese, which people think of, or Mayan, which people think of as encoding concepts rather than sounds, and it turns out that there aren't really Chinese characters that don't correspond to a spoken word. You can often get a great deal more nuance with the written than with a spoken. In other words, there may be several characters which are pronounced the same and which all convey the idea of blue, but in the written form you can specify shades of blue, which is really interesting, okay? But I'm getting a little off my point. The thing is that spoken language is ephemeral and limited in range. Written language makes it possible to convey information of the language, of the language kind, the linguistic kind, through time and space. And it also gives it a physical structure. So you can come up with these ideas of, like, alphabetized lists. This is not something that exists before written language. And I'll refer you to the excellent work Orality and Literacy by Walter Ong, which studies the way that information structures exist in purely oral traditions, like the poetic tradition which gives us the Iliad and the Odyssey. There are some structures for arranging information in there which are very different from the ones which people in literate cultures use, but serve similar functions. That's all really interesting, but again, written language turns out to be a different thing all by itself. It turns out that when you encode information into writing, it winds up being subtly different from the same thing encoded into speech. One of the most hilarious examples of something like this, actually, that I've encountered, was that apparently, so in Korea, classically, they used Chinese characters for writing. And, of course, there's a set of Korean phonetic characters associated with King Sejong the Great, known as the Hangul. And the Hangul are purely phonetic. Well, there was a great revulsion against classical Korean culture in the middle of the 20th century. And so when both North and South Korea emerged after the Second World War, you know, then they tended to reject the use of the old Hanja, as it's called, writing system, the Chinese-based writing system, and adopt the Hangul phonetic writing system. Well, there turn out to be a couple of problems with that, and an example that was pointed out was that the connotation of a word written in Hangul versus Hanja can be different. And the example that I saw was, of course, very near and dear to the hearts of the North Korean communists, underground struggle. That when written in Hanja, that is the Chinese writing system, the phrase underground struggle meant what you think of, you know, people working in secret, this, that, and the other thing. When written in Hangul, it conveyed the idea of fighting under the earth, which I always like to say is the origin of all those tunnels the North Koreans have dug, that they just, took the wrong meaning. I probably shouldn't mock the North Koreans too badly. Apparently they have, you know, intercontinental ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons now, but it's just so difficult. Their capital city is dominated by an enormous building, which is, after 40 years of construction, still not fit for human habitation, and which is routinely airbrushed out of all photographs because they don't like to think about it. A little comment and calm about the Chinese writing system. I'll remark that there actually is a thing informally known as Bopo Mofo, which was an attempt at the beginning of the 20th century to make it easier to learn to read Chinese by making a Chinese syllabic writing system. There's also the pinyin, of course. For a long time, the Chinese government, communist Chinese government, cherished the goal of eliminating Chinese characters and moving over to using the Roman alphabet, which they required to use a lot of diacritical marks and things to make it even halfway comprehensible. And the truth is, you just lose a great deal doing that. Anyway, but that's not what I was going to talk about. What I was going to talk about is how that completely changed, how all that I was just talking about completely changed in the second half of the 19th century. Because almost simultaneously you had the telephone, which annihilated distance. Suddenly, you could talk to somebody on the other side of town. And as the telephone networks in different towns interlinked with each other, you could eventually talk to someone in a different city. And by 100 years ago, you could pick up a telephone in New York and talk to someone in San Francisco on the other side of the continent. That's pretty crazy. But that is the annihilation of distance. It also led very rapidly to the concept of broadcasting. I believe it was in Madrid where they installed a special telephone system so people could listen to the opera in their homes. Of course, the fidelity of reproduction was, shall we say, rather limited, and I don't think the system ever enjoyed any really wide cachet, simply because it was expensive and what you got wasn't great. But if you were a shut-in or something, it might be really wonderful. Anyway, and then about the same time you had the phonograph. Sound had actually been recorded before the phonograph, but never played back. But when Edison played back his first scratchy, distorted cylinder recordings, there's one out there you can hear of Alexander Graham Bell talking into it, who, of course, was deeply involved in both the telephone and sound recording. That was the annihilation of time. Suddenly, what had only ever been instantaneous and local could be protracted over great distances and transmitted through time. An example of the kind of enthusiasm that this, I want to say, fundamental shift in the human condition generated. In the presidential campaign of 1896, there were towns where in their auditoriums were arranged so that people could come and listen to phonograph recordings of the presidential candidates. They had phonograph debates for places where the candidates were unlikely to come. I honestly feel as though this was a bigger change in human life than, say, photography and even moving pictures presented, because we'd had paintings and other drawings, visual representations, for a very long time that would give you at least some idea of what things looked like. But to give you an idea of how things sounded like? Essentially impossible! And then come the telephone and the phonograph. And they make a radical change in one of the most basic of our human technologies, which is spoken language. And why am I saying this? Well, because that's what I'm doing right now. None of you are here in the room with me. Some of the people listening to this are not going to be listening to it live. They're going to be listening to it later. That's something that would have been far into the realm of magic only 150 years ago. That's something, you know, sorcerers in novels could see at great distances. Far less often do you hear of them hearing at great distances or of them hearing sounds from the past. But that's routine now. And so I would like to invite you to think about what kinds of technological changes might arise, what kind of technologies might arise that would have such a massive effect. Because I really don't believe, for example, I mean, computers are good at storing information and at indexing it. That's great, but it's not a radical change. It's a way of automating things, making them faster and easier and more widespread. But it doesn't mark a radical change. And so the next time somebody starts talking about the singularity, maybe the singularity already happened, right? Maybe it happened to circa 1880. Mention of the telharmonium in Com. If you don't know what it is, look it up. But yeah, you know, I'm not going to talk anymore about death cults and apocalypticism because we've already had too much of that this week, right? But I do invite you to consider once again what we can do to create hope, what we can do to build a world that doesn't encourage apocalypticism. Anyway, you've been listening to A Step Farther Out on AnonRadio.net, a service of the SDF Public Access Unix system. If you'd like to support these broadcasts, you can send me money, paypal.me/prometheuslives, Or subscribe to my Patreon campaign, patreon.com/Publius_reads. But please send me your letters. Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. Up next is the Dubious Goals Committee.
7, 6.